University of Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. June Examination Session, 2012. English as a Second Language. Extended Tier. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the test. Look at questions 1 to 6. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. You will hear each item twice. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. How should passengers reach their destinations quickly?
The next southbound underground train has been cancelled. Please wait for further announcements. Or you can travel by a different route if your journey is urgent. Thank you. The next southbound underground train has been cancelled. Please wait for further announcements. Or you can travel by a different route if your journey is urgent. Thank you.
Question 2. At what time must Menaka leave school and why?
Menaka, don't forget your dental appointment is after school today at 4:30.
But I have computer club after school.
That's fine, Menaka. Make sure you leave at 4:20. It's a 10-minute walk to the dentist. Take your watch with you, please. I will meet you there. Menaka, don't forget your dental appointment is after school today at 4:30.
But I have computer club after school.
That's fine, Menaka. Make sure you leave at 4:20. It's a 10-minute walk to the dentist. Take your watch with you, please. I will meet you there.
Question 3. What must Thomas do before he and Yannicka can play squash? Give 2 details.
Thomas, will you teach me to play squash, please? I've got my own racket now.
Okay, Yannicka, I'll book a squash court for us. But I need to buy you a special ball for beginners.
Thank you. I'll look forward to that. Thomas, will you teach me to play squash, please? I've got my own racket now.
Okay, Yannicka, I'll book a squash court for us. But I need to buy you a special ball for beginners.
Thank you. I'll look forward to that.
Question 4. What will the friends receive for their £4 fee? Give 2 details.
Hey, Mohsin. Would you like to come canoeing with me?
I've always wanted to learn to canoe. But where can we do that?
In the open-air pool every Tuesday evening. They have instructors there, and it only costs £4 each per session, including canoe hire and tuition. Hey, Mohsin, would you like to come canoeing with me?
I've always wanted to learn to canoe, but where can we do that?
In the open-air pool every Tuesday evening. They have instructors there, and it only costs £4 each per session, including canoe hire and tuition.
Question 5. Give two details of the offer which Lynn hopes to use.
Hello, everyone. Lynn here. It's my birthday tomorrow, and I'm going to book a table for 12 of us at the new pizza restaurant in the High Street. Its opening offer is two pizzas for the price of one, but only after 6:30 every day. I'll book for 7 o'clock tomorrow evening. Hope you can come. Hello, everyone. Lynn here. It's my birthday tomorrow, and I'm going to book a table for 12 of us at the new pizza restaurant in the High Street. Its opening offer is two pizzas for the price of one, but only after 6:30 every day. I'll book for 7 o'clock tomorrow evening. Hope you can come.
Question 6. For what reason do the friends want to use the rail card? Why are they not successful?
We'd like a return train ticket for 4 children, please, using this special rail card.
You need an adult to travel with you if you use that special rail card.
Oh, but it says up to 4 children under 16 get a 33% reduction when using this card. And we're all still 15 years old.
Look at the small print too. It says, when accompanied by an adult.
We'd like a return train ticket for 4 children, please, using this special rail card.
You need an adult to travel with you if you use that special rail card.
Oh, but it says up to 4 children under 16 get a 33% reduction when using this card. And we're all still 15 years old.
Look at the small print too. It says, when accompanied by an adult.
That is the last of questions 1 to 6. In a moment, you will hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. Listen to the following interview about a special World Cup football tournament and then complete the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Hello and welcome to Sports Weekly. Today we have international sports commentator Arjen Smith with us in the studio. Arjen, welcome.
Thank you. Sports fixtures held worldwide play a large part in our lives nowadays, don't they?
Yes. We read about various World Cups and the Olympic Games and World Athletic events in our newspapers. We watch the sports on TV and the internet and hear the commentaries on the radio as we drive to work in our cars.
We do indeed.
Well, I'm here today to report on a tournament with a difference. It's the Homeless World Cup.
Tell us more.
Did you know that there are 1 billion homeless people in the world?
That's a huge amount.
Yes. And the Homeless World Cup exists to help stop this homelessness and to raise awareness of a basic human need, a home for everyone.
What a wonderful idea. When did this special World Cup start?
The first tournament took place in Graz, in Austria, in 2003. So 2012 will be our 9th tournament.
Do players from all over the world take part?
Oh, yes. The first event had 18 national teams. But the Melbourne Homeless World Cup tournament in Australia in 2006 hosted 56 national teams. In that year, we added a women's tournament too. The Homeless World Cup continues to grow.
Is that the idea?
Yes. The World Cup gives these people the chance to represent their country and can change their lives forever as a result of the training provided.
How do you prepare and train everyone?
We have football trainers in 70 countries working with over 30,000 homeless people throughout the year.
And does playing in the tournament change the lives of your players, do you think?
Oh, yes. We know from letters and emails that over 70% of the players change their lives for the better. They sometimes even go on to become professional players and football coaches.
Arjen, thank you for telling us about the Homeless World Cup. Where can we follow the tournament, please? Is it televised?
It's best to follow us on the internet at www.homelessworldcup.org or listen to Sports Weekly updates.
And how are the tournament and the training actually financed and supported?
Through publicity and fundraising. Football clubs in many countries play and host matches to support us. We have an ambassador who is a famous footballer. And several multinational sports companies help us as sponsors.
Arjen, thank you for telling us about this unique football tournament. We will look out for you all.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Hello and welcome to Sports Weekly. Today we have international sports commentator Arjen Smith with us in the studio. Arjen, welcome.
Thank you. Sports fixtures held worldwide play a large part in our lives nowadays, don't they?
Yes. We read about various World Cups and the Olympic Games and world athletic events in our newspapers. We watch the sports on TV and the internet and hear the commentaries on the radio as we drive to work in our cars.
We do indeed. Well, I'm here today to report on a tournament with a difference. It's the Homeless World Cup.
Tell us more.
Did you know that there are 1 billion homeless people in the world?
That's a huge amount.
Yes. And the Homeless World Cup exists to help stop this homelessness and to raise awareness of a basic human need, a home for everyone.
What a wonderful idea. When did this special World Cup start?
The first tournament took place in Graz, in Austria, in 2003. So 2012 will be our 9th tournament.
Do players from all over the world take part?
Oh, yes. The first event had 18 national teams.
But the Melbourne Homeless World Cup tournament in Australia in 2006 hosted 56 national teams. In that year, we added a women's tournament too. The Homeless World Cup continues to grow.
Is that the idea?
Yes. The World Cup gives these people the chance to represent their country and can change their lives forever as a result of the training provided.
How do you prepare and train everyone?
We have football trainers in 70 countries working with over 30,000 homeless people throughout the year.
And does playing in the tournament change the lives of your players, do you think?
Oh, yes. We know from letters and emails that over 70% of the players change their lives for the better. They sometimes even go on to become professional players and football coaches.
Arjen, thank you for telling us about the Homeless World Cup. Where can we follow the tournament, please? Is it televised?
It's best to follow us on the internet at www.homelessworldcup.org or listen to Sports Weekly updates.
And how are the tournament and the training actually financed and supported?
Through publicity and fundraising. Football clubs in many countries play and host matches to support us. We have an ambassador who is a famous footballer. And several multinational sports companies help us as sponsors.
Arjen, thank you for telling us about this unique football tournament. We will look out for you all.
That is the end of question 7. In a moment, you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8. Listen to the following interview about pomegranates and then complete the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Hello and welcome to You Are What You Eat, our weekly diet programme. Today we're going to discuss the benefits of an unusual fruit, the pomegranate. Expert Pfizer Moss is with us in the studio to tell us more.
Thank you. I noticed that you called the pomegranate an unusual fruit. Actually, it has been around since ancient times and is now grown all over the world.
Where were pomegranates first grown, Pfizer?
Originally, they were grown in the area which is now modern-day Iran and Iraq. Then they were carried along the Silk Route by traders as far as China. In fact, there are still thriving pomegranate orchards in Xi'an, the old Chinese capital.
Did the popularity of pomegranates stop there?
No, they were then grown all around the Mediterranean, further east, and eventually in all sunny climates. Recently, Afghanistan has held a pomegranate celebration. It exported 50,000 tons of the fruit in 2008, rising to 80,000 tons in 2009, and that quantity is still increasing.
You can buy the juice from the new Kabul factory in shops all around the world now, you know.
Yes. That £6 million factory opened in October 2009. It was designed specifically to produce pomegranate juice, and very successfully too.
This interest in pomegranates must be good news for the farmers.
Yes, it is. Did you know that when their fruits were first exported, farmers received 34 pence per kilogram, but now they are earning over £1 per kilogram?
Why is that? Is it because consumers are now more aware of the health benefits of drinking the juice?
Yes. In the UK alone, the market for pomegranate juice has increased to £21 million each year. The juice is lovely, but expensive. Look out for special offers.
I know, I do. I've even tried extracting my own juice, but it's not easy because of all the pomegranate seeds.
That's why farmers are trying to develop a seedless variety of pomegranate, because of the demand for seedless fruit to make juice from. It is thought that fruit without seeds will become very popular with consumers worldwide.
Pomegranates are prized for their wonderful health-giving properties, aren't they? The juice is meant to help prevent heart disease, isn't it?
Yes. Scientists have found that pomegranate juice is high in antioxidants, which protect the body from bad chemicals in the blood. It is thought that pomegranate juice may contain 3 times the amount of antioxidants found in green tea.
Wow! That makes pomegranates the new superfood.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Hello and welcome to You Are What You Eat, our weekly diet programme. Today we are going to discuss the benefits of an unusual fruit, the pomegranate. Expert Faiza Moss is with us in the studio to tell us more.
Thank you. I noticed that you called the pomegranate an unusual fruit. Actually, it has been around since ancient times and is now grown all over the world.
Where were pomegranates first grown, Faiza?
Originally, they were grown in the area which is now modern-day Iran and Iraq. Then they were carried along the Silk Route by traders as far as China. In fact, there are still thriving pomegranate orchards in Xi'an, the old Chinese capital.
Did the popularity of pomegranates stop there?
No. They were then grown all around the Mediterranean, further east, and eventually in all sunny climates. Recently, Afghanistan has held a pomegranate celebration. It exported 50,000 tons of the fruit in 2008, rising to 80,000 tons in 2009, and that quantity is still increasing.
You can buy the juice from the new Kabul factory in shops all around the world now, you know.
Yes, that £6 million factory opened in October 2009. It was designed specifically to produce pomegranate juice, and very successfully too.
This interest in pomegranates must be good news for the farmers.
Yes, it is. Did you know that when their fruits were first exported, farmers received 34 pence per kilogram, but now they are earning over £1 per kilogram?
Why is that? Is it because consumers are now more aware of the health benefits of drinking the juice?
Yes. In the UK alone, the market for pomegranate juice has increased to £21 million each year. The juice is lovely, but expensive. Look out for special offers.
I know, I do. I've even tried extracting my own juice, but it's not easy because of all the pomegranate seeds.
That's why farmers are trying to develop a seedless variety of pomegranate, because of the demand for seedless fruit to make juice from. It is thought that fruit without seeds will become very popular with consumers worldwide.
Pomegranates are prized for their wonderful health-giving properties, aren't they? The juice is meant to help prevent heart disease, isn't it?
Yes. Scientists have found that pomegranate juice is high in antioxidants, which protect the body from bad chemicals in the blood. It is thought that pomegranate juice may contain 3 times the amount of antioxidants found in green tea.
Wow. That makes pomegranates the new superfood.
That is the end of question 8. In a moment, you will hear question 9. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam.
You'll hear a radio interview with Mike Reynolds, whose hobby is exploring underground places such as caves. For questions 9 to 18, complete the sentences. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part 2.
In the studio with me today, I have Mike Reynolds, who's what is known as a caver. In other words, he spends long periods of time exploring underground caves for pleasure. And Mike's here to tell us all about this fascinating hobby and how to get started on it. So, Mike, why caves?
Well, cavers actually explore any space that's underground, whether it's caves, old mines or tunnels.
Oh, right. So how big are these underground spaces?
Oh, anything up to 80 kilometres long? Which means that in some cases, in order to reach the end, you've got to sleep, to set up camp inside the cave at some point, usually where both space and fresh air are available.
No good if you're afraid of the dark.
No.
So where do you find the best caves?
In terms of countries, the best places are, for example, Ireland, Australia and the Philippines. Here in the UK, various areas have the right sort of geology. My favourite is Wales, but you can find plenty of caves in northern England and in Scotland too.
Mm. Caving involves a lot of physical exercise, doesn't it?
That's right. In terms of physical activity, it's very similar to climbing, except they go up and we go down. The conditions can be very different though. We often find ourselves facing very small gaps in the rock, which we have to crawl through on our hands and knees.
So the right equipment is obviously very important. If I wanted to start out on a hobby like this, what would I need?
Well, you'd need a hard hat, and it's important to get one that fits properly so that it doesn't keep falling over your eyes or feel too tight. And these can cost anything from £5 to £20.
Hmm, that doesn't sound too much for starters.
Oh, but then there's the lamp. You wear that on your head, because it's very important to keep your hands free at all times. But it doesn't come with the hat, and it can cost anything up to £50 to get a suitable one.
Hmm, I guess warm clothes are a must too.
You'll need to spend £30 to £40 on a waterproof suit, because the caves can be pretty wet and cold inside, and you can get ill if you're not protected. Then, of course, the thing that you really need to spend money on is something for your feet that keeps the water out. Strong boots are essential for this. Also, because without them, you could be slipping on wet surfaces and doing yourself an injury. Cheap ones are just not as safe, I'm afraid.
Hmm. Well, it sounds pretty tough. I mean, is it really only a sport for the young and fit?
That's quite interesting, because people tend to think that. But in fact, cavers come from all ages and backgrounds, students and professionals alike. You even find 80-year-olds who've been doing it for years.
What exactly is it that people find so attractive?
It's excitement. The pleasure you get in finding something new. A passage that nobody knew about before, or a piece of rock that's just lovely to look at.
Mm. And I understand that conservation has become a key issue as well.
Yes, 48 caves in Britain are now known as places of special interest because of what they contain. And this is the same in other countries too.
So do cavers enjoy competing like in other sports?
No. We want to enjoy a safe sport, and in order to ensure that, there are no competitions in caving. We try to organise a range of events, but the emphasis is on cooperation and the enjoyment of the sport for what it can offer the individual.
Well, it sounds like something I'll have to try one day. Mike, thank you very much for coming in and sharing.
Now you'll hear part two again.
In the studio with me today, I have Mike Reynolds, who's what is known as a caver. In other words, he spends long periods of time exploring underground caves for pleasure. And Mike's here to tell us all about this fascinating hobby and how to get started on it. So, Mike, why caves?
Well, cavers actually explore any space that's underground, whether it's caves, old mines or tunnels.
Oh, right. So how big are these underground spaces?
Oh, anything up to 80 kilometres long. Which means that in some cases, in order to reach the end, you've got to sleep, to set up camp inside the cave at some point, usually where both space and fresh air are available.
No good if you're afraid of the dark.
No.
So where do you find the best caves?
In terms of countries, the best places are, for example, Ireland, Australia and the Philippines. Here in the UK, various areas have the right sort of geology. My favourite is Wales, but you can find plenty of caves in northern England and in Scotland too.
Mm. Caving involves a lot of physical exercise, doesn't it?
That's right. In terms of physical activity, it's very similar to climbing, except they go up and we go down. The conditions can be very different, though. We often find ourselves facing very small gaps in the rock, which we have to crawl through on our hands and knees.
So the right equipment is obviously very important. If I wanted to start out on a hobby like this, what would I need?
Well, you'd need a hard hat, and it's important to get one that fits properly, so that it doesn't keep falling over your eyes or feel too tight. And these can cost anything from £5 to £20.
Hmm, that doesn't sound too much for starters.
Oh, but then there's the lamp. You wear that on your head, because it's very important to keep your hands free at all times. But it doesn't come with the hat, and it can cost anything up to £50 to get a suitable one.
Hmm, I guess warm clothes are a must too.
You'll need to spend £30 to £40 on a waterproof suit, because the caves can be pretty wet and cold inside, and you can get ill if you're not protected. Then, of course, the thing that you really need to spend money on is something for your feet that keeps the water out. Strong boots are essential for this. Also, because without them, you could be slipping on wet surfaces and doing yourself an injury. Cheap ones are just not as safe, I'm afraid.
Hmm. Well, it sounds pretty tough. I mean, is it really only a sport for the young and fit?
That's quite interesting, because people tend to think that. But in fact, cavers come from all ages and backgrounds, students and professionals alike. You even find 80-year-olds who've been doing it for years.
What exactly is it that people find so attractive?
It's excitement. The pleasure you get in finding something new. A passage that nobody knew about before, or a piece of rock that's just lovely to look at.
Mm. And I understand that conservation has become a key issue as well.
Yes, 48 caves in Britain are now known as places of special interest because of what they contain. And this is the same in other countries too.
So do cavers enjoy competing like in other sports?
No. We want to enjoy a safe sport, and in order to ensure that, there are no competitions in caving. We try to organise a range of events, but the emphasis is on cooperation and the enjoyment of the sport for what it can offer the individual.
Well, it sounds like something I'll have to try one day. Mike, thank you very much for coming in and sharing.
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You'll hear five different people talking about their work on a cruise ship. For questions 19 to 23, choose from the list A to F what each speaker says about their work. Use the letters only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You now have 30 seconds in which to look at part three. Speaker 1.
I deal with anything to do with entertainment on board, and that covers guest lecturers, cabaret artists, the show company, and any special nights. I have to plan each cruise with all the performers, and then introduce them at the beginning of the show. There's never a dull moment. And if I want time to myself, I have to escape to my cabin, because a huge part of my job is to mix with people. There are often parties to attend, and then sometimes dance nights to organise. So, if I'm not in the shows, I'll be out there dancing with the passengers, because that's part of my job too.
Speaker 2.
I'm in charge of reception at the Health and Fitness Centre, so I greet passengers and organise their individual fitness programmes and beauty treatments. I wouldn't say it was glamorous, because it's very hard work, but the rewards for me are meeting really interesting people, and the system of working. We do 8-month contracts, and once you've finished, it's up to you how much time you have off. Then you renew your contract when you're ready. I like working on a contract basis. I don't like to feel as if I'm stuck somewhere. At home, everyone follows the same 9-to-5 pattern. Here, time just has a different meaning.
Speaker 3.
I'm responsible for the safety of the passengers. That means that apart from keeping an eye on things on a day-to-day basis, I have to make sure that passengers can be safely evacuated if there's an emergency. So I do a lot of staff training to make sure each member of staff knows exactly what to do if there's a problem. And, of course, we do emergency drills with the passengers. In theory, I'm on call for 24 hours a day, but in fact I'm generally on duty for about 15, so I do get the chance to socialise a bit too. When we're in port, though, I get the whole time off.
Speaker 4.
There are 6 photographers here, and we take photos of passengers in various locations on the ship. My main role, though, is to develop and print all the passenger films, so I'm less in evidence socially. We don't have set hours because every cruise programme is different, and because I print the photos, I frequently carry on working until 6 in the morning, getting them ready for the next day. It's quite exciting. People like having their pictures taken with the captain, and we also do quite a few shots in the restaurant and on party nights, but generally people come to us with their own requests.
Speaker 5.
I'm in charge of all the restaurants on board, so menus, costings and the quality of food, plus any staff issues, it's all down to me. I love all that, even if the paperwork and accounts can be a bit dull sometimes. But I've worked for this company for nearly 24 years, and I haven't regretted it for one minute. Even though we can't choose where we go, we can put in requests for certain cruises. So normally I do 4 months away and then 2 months leave. Where else could you get a job like that and get paid for it? You miss your friends and family, but you don't get time to think about it.
Now you'll hear part three again. Speaker one.
I deal with anything to do with entertainment on board, and that covers guest lecturers, cabaret artists, the show company, and any special nights. I have to plan each cruise with all the performers, and then introduce them at the beginning of the show. There's never a dull moment. And if I want time to myself, I have to escape to my cabin, because a huge part of my job is to mix with people. There are often parties to attend, and then sometimes dance nights to organise. So, if I'm not in the shows, I'll be out there dancing with the passengers, because that's part of my job too.
Speaker 2.
I'm in charge of reception at the Health and Fitness Centre, so I greet passengers and organise their individual fitness programmes and beauty treatments. I wouldn't say it was glamorous because it's very hard work, but the rewards for me are meeting really interesting people and the system of working. We do 8-month contracts, and once you've finished, it's up to you how much time you have off. Then you renew your contract when you're ready. I like working on a contract basis. I don't like to feel as if I'm stuck somewhere. At home, everyone follows the same 9-to-5 pattern. Here, time just has a different meaning.
Speaker 3.
I'm responsible for the safety of the passengers. That means that apart from keeping an eye on things on a day-to-day basis, I have to make sure that passengers can be safely evacuated if there's an emergency. So I do a lot of staff training to make sure each member of staff knows exactly what to do if there's a problem. And, of course, we do emergency drills with the passengers. In theory, I'm on call for 24 hours a day, but in fact, I'm generally on duty for about 15, so I do get the chance to socialise a bit, too. When we're in port, though, I get the whole time off.
Speaker 4.
There are 6 photographers here, and we take photos of passengers in various locations on the ship. My main role, though, is to develop and print all the passenger films, so I'm less in evidence socially. We don't have set hours because every cruise programme is different, and because I print the photos, I frequently carry on working until 6 in the morning, getting them ready for the next day. It's quite exciting. People like having their pictures taken with the captain, and we also do quite a few shots in the restaurant and on party nights, but generally people come to us with their own requests.
Speaker 5.
I'm in charge of all the restaurants on board, so menus, costings and the quality of food, plus any staff issues, it's all down to me. I love all that, even if the paperwork and accounts can be a bit dull sometimes. But I've worked for this company for nearly 24 years, and I haven't regretted it for one minute. Even though we can't choose where we go, we can put in requests for certain cruises. So normally I do 4 months away and then 2 months leave. Where else could you get a job like that and get paid for it? You miss your friends and family, but you don't get time to think about it.
That's the end of part three. Now turn to part four. You will hear an interview with a man called Stan Leach, who is talking about adventure sports. For questions 24 to 30, choose the best answer A, B or C. You now have 1 minute in which to look at part four.
Welcome back to the programme. Well, statistics show that the fastest growing sports in Britain are adventure sports. And I have with me Stan Leach, an official at the Sports Council, who's going to tell us a bit about some of them. Stan, where shall we start?
Well, most people start with walking, I think. Although, of course, strictly speaking, it's not necessarily an adventure sport. But it's what gets most people outdoors. Indeed, the great thing about walking in Britain is the endless variety. From an easy stroll to a country pub, to an energetic walk up a high peak. If you want to take up walking, you can start with a few short circular walks, and then pick something longer and more demanding.
What's this thing called scrambling I've been hearing about?
Yeah. Scrambling is sort of in the grey area between walking and climbing. Scrambles are graded according to difficulty, and on the harder ones, which are quite close to rock climbing, it's best to go with an expert.
Well, that brings us nicely on to climbing. That's really caught on here lately, hasn't it?
Yes. And of course, you know it doesn't have to mean going up the really big ones like Everest. Climbing might seem rather terrifying to begin with, but it's great fun and really keeps you fit. You start by climbing small crags before moving on to a rock face. I went for a day's lesson with mountaineer Alan Kimber in Scotland, and it was really scary, but really exciting.
Right. Well, what's next?
Mountain biking. If you can get used to the saddle, you can cycle across Britain. But unlike in the USA, where there are special cycling paths, in Britain, most of the paths are the same as for walkers, which can cause a bit of trouble. After the initial investment, there's one bike that costs £4,000, but you can get a very good one for £200. It's a cost-efficient sport. And there are relatively easy trips, such as the Pyrenees Traverse, which has 70% downhill slopes with no major climbs.
Scuba diving's my personal favourite. Any advice on that?
Yes. Swimming underwater opens up a whole new world. Actually, for most people, the idea of being underwater, unable to breathe normally, is a frightening one. But with good tuition, you can pick it up in no time at all. Once you get the qualification you need to be considered a competent diver, you can do it anywhere.
I see you've got skydiving on your list. Surely that's only for people who are very brave or mad.
Well, it is the sort of thing you'd expect to only see in the movies. But you'd be amazed how many people go in for it these days. 6 hours of training will give you enough background to make the first jump. People who really take to it often join display teams. So if you take it up, you might find yourself taking part in special events.
Okay. And finally, canoeing. That always looks a bit dangerous to me, in that tiny boat with water rushing everywhere.
Well, there are some terrible bits of water where the real canoeing experts go. But beginners can start in gentler waters and build up. There's one stretch in Wales that was designed for the World Championships that has a dam release, so that at preset times the water runs through. You can phone up and they'll say it's a full release tomorrow, or a quarter release. So you can choose your times according to difficulty.
OK, Stan, thanks a lot. After the break, we'll be going to Canada to look...
Now you'll hear part four again.
Welcome back to the programme. Well, statistics show that the fastest growing sports in Britain are adventure sports. And I have with me Stan Leach, an official at the Sports Council, who's going to tell us a bit about some of them. Stan, where shall we start?
Well, most people start with walking, I think. Although, of course, strictly speaking, it's not necessarily an adventure sport. But it's what gets most people outdoors. Indeed, the great thing about walking in Britain is the endless variety. From an easy stroll to a country pub, to an energetic walk up a high peak. If you want to take up walking, you can start with a few short circular walks, and then pick something longer and more demanding.
What's this thing called scrambling I've been hearing about?
Yeah. Scrambling is sort of in the grey area between walking and climbing. Scrambles are graded according to difficulty, and on the harder ones, which are quite close to rock climbing, it's best to go with an expert.
Well, that brings us nicely on to climbing. That's really caught on here lately, hasn't it?
Yes. And, of course, you know it doesn't have to mean going up the really big ones like Everest. Climbing might seem rather terrifying to begin with, but it's great fun and really keeps you fit. You start by climbing small crags before moving on to a rock face. I went for a day's lesson with mountaineer Alan Kimber in Scotland, and it was really scary but really exciting.
Right. Well, what's next?
Mountain biking. If you can get used to the saddle, you can cycle across Britain. But unlike in the USA, where there are special cycling paths, in Britain, most of the paths are the same as for walkers, which can cause a bit of trouble. After the initial investment, there's one bike that costs £4,000, but you can get a very good one for £200. It's a cost-efficient sport. And there are relatively easy trips, such as the Pyrenees Traverse, which has 70% downhill slopes with no major climbs.
Scuba diving's my personal favourite. Any advice on that?
Yes. Swimming underwater opens up a whole new world. Actually, for most people, the idea of being underwater, unable to breathe normally, is a frightening one. But with good tuition, you can pick it up in no time at all. Once you get the qualification you need to be considered a competent diver, you can do it anywhere.
I see you've got skydiving on your list. Surely that's only for people who are very brave or mad.
Well, it is the sort of thing you'd expect to only see in the movies. But you'd be amazed how many people go in for it these days. 6 hours of training will give you enough background to make the first jump. People who really take to it often join display teams. So if you take it up, you might find yourself taking part in special events.
Okay. And finally, canoeing. That always looks a bit dangerous to me, in that tiny boat with water rushing everywhere.
Well, there are some terrible bits of water where the real canoeing experts go, but beginners can start in gentler waters and build up. There's one stretch in Wales that was designed for the World Championships that has a dam release, so that at preset times the water runs through. You can phone up and they'll say it's a full release tomorrow, or a quarter release. So you can choose your times according to difficulty.
OK, Stan, thanks a lot. After the break, we'll be going to Canada to look...
That is the end of part four. There will now be a pause of 5 minutes for you to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. Be sure to follow the numbering of all the questions. I shall remind you when there is 1 minute left, so that you are sure to finish in time. That is the end of the test. Please stop now. Your supervisor will now collect all the question papers and answer sheets.